Hello, my name is Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy. Usually before the show starts, I try to think of something funny to say that is at least marginally related to the show or the show title. But today, I couldn't really think of anything related, but I did think of something funny as I was setting things up to record. In a year from now, today is March 15th, 2016. On March 15th of 2017, it is very possible that we will be saying President Donald Trump. I feel like that is a joke in and of itself. I think that's probably the single best reason to vote for Donald Trump, is that it would be kind of funny. I think the second best reason is that, why not? He is as good as any other candidate running who has a chance to actually win. Even though it would be funny, I'm still not going to vote for him, and I don't want him to win, but I do want him to win as much as I want any other candidate to win. It would be nice if we could figure out a way where every candidate loses.
We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it.
All right. Well, if you're a careful listener who reads the titles of these podcasts and remembers things that I said in the past, you'll realize you're not going to be getting today what I originally said I was going to give you. The reason is that what I was going to talk about was give a biblical justification of violence. And the reason I'm not doing that today is because I like deceiving you and engaging in fraudulent behavior with the implicit contract that I have with my listeners. I didn't scrap the episode or delay it because I wasn't sure what to say or anything like that. I just ran into an idea on Sunday I wanted to think about a little more and flesh out a little more. It was a fresh idea to me, which I found interesting, that I wanted to spend some time thinking about and talking about, so why not gather some thoughts together and do a podcast on it, since it will be somewhat related when I at least finally finish talking about it. The truth is, lately doing this podcast has felt a little laborious, and preparation for some of these topics has become a little dull. All this despite an increasing frequency of emails and other internet messages thanking me and telling me to keep up the good work, which are things that I've found quite encouraging, and I thank you all for them. But they're not enough for me to keep going with this indefinitely. I think this particular passion project is winding down a little bit as my passion for communicating in this particular way, in this particular style of presentation, is also decreasing. But when I have a fresh idea that is new to me like this one, it's a little rejuvenating to have the opportunity to share it with others, even if some of my thoughts on it will be a little weak still, and a lot of it, I think, could be misguided. It will hopefully still be interesting. So in my church, we've been going through the letters to the Thessalonians very quickly, one chapter a week, to finish up before Easter. Last week's episode was marginally related to my church's journey through the text, and this week I will be talking about 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 exclusively. So I guess let's read that quick. Not the whole chapter, just 2 Thessalonians 2 verses 1 through 10. In it, Paul, Silas, and Timothy, who are the triumvirate letter writers to the Thessalonian church, they say, "Now concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered together to him, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by a spirit or a spoken word or a letter seeming to be from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And you know what is restraining him now, so that he may be revealed in his time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains it will do so until he is out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth, and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan with all power and false signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing, because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. You may notice there is a lot going on here. First off, let's do a sidetrack and go after Eugene Peterson. That old man has gotten away with destroying scripture with his message version for far too long. When will someone finally criticize it? I actually like Eugene. I've read a couple of books by him, and he is a solid reader of scripture in my estimation. I even appreciate the message version as something that is helpful for a lot of people, as long as they consider it a kind of commentary-esque paraphrase and not just a translation. So any of my mocking of him is purely lighthearted and meaningless. But do you know how he paraphrases the phrase man of lawlessness in The Message? He calls him the man of anarchy. Come on, Eugenie in a bottle. Anarchists have a bad enough name without you calling men driven by Satan who kill ruthlessly and set themselves up as gods, men of anarchy. He obviously has no idea what anarchy means. And as I will point out at some point in this podcast, calling this person the man of anarchy makes no sense when anarchy means without rulers. The letter to the Thessalonians was written in about 52 AD, or CE, I guess, is the proper use now. I don't really care if you know what I mean. During the reign of Claudius, a little more than a decade after this, tensions were rising across the Roman Empire. There were revolts in many different regions. Jews in Judea were becoming increasingly problematic. And Christianity, the tiny Jewish sect who declared often that Jesus is Lord, had grown so big by 64 AD and was seen as such a threat that Emperor Nero, the one who succeeded Claudius, started persecuting the Christians. In the mid-60s, the rebellion talked about in 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 3 occurred. The Jews violently rebelled against Rome. The word for rebellion in the text is the root of our modern word apostasy. It's apostas something, but I can't remember it exactly. It can either mean religious or a political rebellion, and some translations will talk about it more as a spiritual rebellion. And while it is true that the Jews are engaged in a spiritual rebellion as a whole, because as a whole they rejected Jesus, the historical context and the context of the violence of the text makes it pretty clear we should primarily understand this rebellion as being a political one. Because of this rebellion and its growing size, the war on the Jews was declared by Rome in 67 AD. You'll notice that even though Paul, Silas, and Timothy are talking about specific people and specific events at a specific place, they use a lot of metaphorical language to describe the situation. While this is commonplace for prophecies, it's also likely the authors do not want to name any names specifically at this point. They have enough enemies and barriers to the spread of the gospel without calling out by name men of lawlessness and in writing no less, who have the power to make the movement of the message even more difficult. If they are confident, the Thessalonian church will know what they mean, and they seem to be quite confident about this. then it behooves them to be somewhat covert for their own safety. Okay, so let's do some work talking about the man of lawlessness and he who restrains him. Who are these dudes? Well, first, we'll go a little out of order as it relates to the text and talk about the Emperor Claudius, because he is the easiest one to pin down historically. Claudius was Caesar at the time of the writing of the letter to the Thessalonians, and it is very likely he is the man Paul was referencing as the restrainer of the man of lawlessness. Claudius was not as aggressive with his power against people like the Jews as the Caesars who came after him. By being the one in power rather than these other ones, he prevented the future emperors from taking power. The future violent men of lawlessness were restrained because they didn't have the full powers of the Caesar yet. So they were restrained by Claudius's somewhat less aggressive and more restrained nature. Additionally, the name Claudius is of Latin origin and is very similar to the Latin word claudire, which means restraint. So the restrainer Paul is talking about has a name with a cognate which means restrainer. It is likely the description of the passage and the wordplay of the word restrainer in conjunction with what the Thessalonian church already knew would point directly to Claudius as the restrainer who will do so until he is out of the way. Things get a little more blurry when we talk about who the man of lawlessness is. There's more disagreement surrounding it, at least. Many think the man of lawlessness is Nero, who came to power a few years after the letter was written. When Claudius died of old age, basically, or some disease people get when they're old. Some think it could also be the tandem of Caesars who came to power after Nero in 68 AD. It was a father-son team of former generals named Titus Vespasian and Titus. Still others think it could be a reference to the series of Caesars from Nero to Titus, who together fulfill the prophecies to the Thessalonians. The case for Nero is pretty strong. Nero was around and somewhat known during the time of the letter, and was waiting for Claudius, the Caesar who was, relatively speaking, not so lawless, to depart from his throne. So, the mystery of lawlessness was already at work. Nero, the man of lawlessness, was already around. When he did come to power, Nero committed some very heavy-handed acts of violence against the Jewish people. He declared himself to be God, and there were even people who would ceremoniously declare Caesar as Lord in cities across the empire. As Caesar, he was the god all the citizens of Rome were to follow, regardless of whatever their particular individual religions were. He is the one who opposed Christ by persecuting Christians, and was the one who started the war to quash the Jewish rebellion. As I think I mentioned last week, or at least I should have mentioned, historians talk about people performing signs and wonders in this tense time in Jerusalem. He also committed suicide in 68 AD, which could be seen as a fulfillment of Jesus killing him with the breath of his mouth at the appearance of his coming. If you remember last week, the judgment of Jerusalem was talked about by Jesus as him coming on the clouds. So in this text, the appearance of Jesus coming is also the judgment of Jerusalem, and during this judgment, Nero was killed. He's a pretty good candidate for the man of lawlessness. There were a couple of things Nero didn't do, however. He didn't finish off the destruction of Jerusalem. While he did set himself against every kind of god as the true god of the empire, he didn't end up physically setting himself up in the middle of the Jewish temple of God. However, it's possible to consider the temple of God phrase as symbolic of the place where God is worshipped. And Nero does set himself up as the person who is the one that should be worshipped wherever the true God is worshipped. He seeks to supplant Jesus in the gathering of believers. that is, the new temple of God. But he didn't physically set himself up in the temple. This is a big part of the reason why some think that the co-Caesars of Titus Vespasius and his son Titus, who succeeded Nero, are together the man of lawlessness. These two were also known as generals of Nero's army who were leading the Roman war against the Jews. They took power after Nero's death and finished off Jerusalem in AD 70. Titus invaded the temple itself in 70 CE. And Josephus records that the victorious Roman army put up symbols of the emperor in the temple and at the eastern gate had animal sacrifices to desecrate the holy place. In what was the dwelling of God for the Jews, the Caesar was worshipped. After they did this, they burned the temple to the ground. It's reminiscent of the words of Jesus we talked about last week, where he mentions the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. The actions of Titus appear to be a closer representation of a man standing in the temple and opposing himself to every kind of so-called god, including Yahweh, than the actions of Nero. I'm personally inclined to think about the man of lawlessness as beginning with Nero and ending with Titus. It's a reference to the line of emperors immediately following Claudius the Restrainer. Although I don't hold to this view with much vigor, I just think it makes the most sense of the whole passage, but I think there are pretty good arguments for multiple emperors, and I don't think it would take too much to convince me that I'm wrong about this. If we do think about the man of lawlessness as a reference to the line of Caesars after Claudius, some might find this to be unfitting, as the man of lawlessness is a singular term. But we need not think this way. We should give the authors of the letter some leeway and some room for literary flexibility. When talking in somewhat obscured metaphor to a group you believe will understand what you are saying, the church in Thessalonica, there is no need to be absolutely precise with their language if they are confident the church knows what they mean. Many prophecies are done this way, where metaphors are used and are not as exacting as simply coming out and saying in plain language what was going to happen and who was going to do it. Instead, they use metaphors that had some degree of flexibility to talk about different situations where God was working to bring justice. This doesn't mean, of course, thinking that they were referencing the line of Caesars is correct. It just means that using man, a singular term, when talking about multiple men, shouldn't be much of a deterrent, because we need not be so rigid in our examination of these words. To reiterate simply, the man of lawlessness who does these terrible things is Nero, Titus, or both. We know why the authors might not want to be completely explicit, as it might put them in danger. But why talk about him as the man of lawlessness? Why phrase it this way? In what way was the Caesar lawless? It's an odd word to describe him or them, because the Caesars all have power through the Roman laws. Their power over Rome comes right from Roman legislation. The law declares them to be gods. The law gives them authority to direct the armies to destroy Jerusalem or to erect idols in the Jewish temple. The law places them as the highest ranking authority in the land. Their lawful right to do whatever they please is not absolute, as I understand it, but it's pretty close. How could a man whom the law empowers to do nearly whatever he wants be described as lawless? I contend it is precisely because the law gave Caesar special authority that he was able to be a man of lawlessness. When the authors talk about lawlessness, they cannot be referring to Roman law. They must be referring to a higher law than Caesar himself. the enforcement of unjust laws of the empire gave Caesar the authority and the might to be a superhuman lawbreaker. He didn't break Roman law, but he broke laws far more important and far higher than the laws of Rome. He broke God's laws of do not murder or do not steal, and he broke many other natural laws, engaging in massive violations of other people and their property. He violates the image of God in others through his lawlessness, and he is able to bring massive destruction without consequence precisely because of the Roman laws which give him the authority to do so. When I said authority, you can picture me putting my hands up in quotations, meaning I don't really think the authority given to him by the Roman law is a legitimate authority. And this Roman law puts him in a position where he can act as one above the law. This makes him functionally lawless. Thus, he's a man of lawlessness. When we analyze the man of lawlessness, we find he is the exact opposite of what Eugene Peterson calls him. He is not a man of anarchy, but a man who actually was anarche, meaning a man who actually was a ruler. He wasn't lawless because there was no ruler. He was lawless precisely because he was the ruler. This was not a case of a man who had no ruler being lawless, but a man who was the ruler. Being the ruler, being a member of the ruling class, made lawlessness possible. A lack of rulers in society was not the issue here. It was the fact that they existed at all. A lack of rulers was not the cause of his lawlessness. So in your face, Mr. Peterson, or more like Mr. Urinterson, you get it. It's very clever. Trust me, highbrow humor is my specialty. That's the basic gist of some of my thoughts on that passage, as well as some of the historical background. During my friend's teaching on the text on Sunday, he talked about applying this passage to our lives and to our world today. He talked about seeing the man of lawlessness in this text as a sort of an archetype, and talked about there being men of lawlessness throughout history. So I've been considering this idea a little bit about the man of lawlessness being an archetype over the last 36 hours, and I've been thinking and considering, when we look at our world today, who is the man of lawlessness, or perhaps who are the men of lawlessness? Obviously, they can be women too. This isn't really my default mode of thinking of texts like this. I usually just end up explaining the text by telling people what the authors were talking about and leaving it there. But it's been an interesting thought process thinking about how to apply this archetype. I understand this isn't an application of the text the authors of 2 Thessalonians originally intended. But hey, lots of writers in the New Testament are kind of liberal with their application of Old Testament scriptures to explain modern events. I figure I can use the language of this story and of this passage to apply to the modern world, if at the same time I at least acknowledge I'm not claiming this is what Paul was talking about, but instead finding parallels with the ancient world of the early church for the purposes of solidarity and perhaps discovering some insight into our present time. To figure out who these people are, if they exist at all, we should try to keep in mind what it was that made Caesar or the Caesars a man of lawlessness in the first place. He was lawless because he received special protection from the laws and from the government system of Rome. He violated the rights of others and treated them brutally because he could do so without consequence. The lawlessness was not about him breaking Roman laws, but about Roman laws assisting him in treating people unethically, and thus was lawless because he violated higher laws. The laws of the state give him the power and the authority to commit so much lawlessness. If we look at the political class, I believe we can see some of this lawlessness in action. There are some obvious things where we see politicians making laws which exempt Congress, exempt the very people who are making those laws, The political class frequently engages in insider trading, which you can't do if you're not in that class, and they often make laws to benefit whatever companies they are invested in, using the force of government to hurt other customers, investors, and other companies in order to benefit themselves. They make laws which are an inherent violation of the rights of others and enable violence to be done to humanity in the name of law enforcement. Thus, they make laws which violate higher laws and so, in that sense, are lawless because they come into conflict with more basic higher laws like don't steal. They pass budgets which rely on theft. They enact sanctions which kill people through the prevention of trade. They empower wars which kill thousands of innocent people. They act lawlessly by aggressing against people through the creation of their laws. In addition to this, it seems like every month there is another politician who does something illegal and gets away with it without having to go to jail or anything because they are a member of the ruling class. It is so rare that any of these people, even if they do something like oversee international war crimes, will go to prison. They probably won't even have to go to court for the breaking of their law. Some people might even praise them for it. Politicians are often above the law, and so are enabled to behave lawlessly. This doesn't mean all of them do behave lawlessly. It just means that if we are looking for lawless people, this group in particular is likely to produce them because it makes such lawlessness more possible than for your average person. There are also many large corporations who engage in lawless type behavior through lobbying and under-the-table promises of things like a job with their company. These businesses use political power and influence to be above it all. They use the violence of the state to make their laws, to make laws which hurt their competition, to acquire subsidies from the taxpayer, and to give their company special exemptions from the law. In some cases, like the BP oil spill a few years ago in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, these companies will bribe individuals with power to look the other way. The largest of these financiers of politicians are the people who functionally run the government. As one recent study found, the U.S. is run much more like an oligarchy, where a small group of people run the government, rather than a democracy. Not that a democracy is good, obviously, or even necessarily better than an oligarchy. It's merely to point out that a relatively small group of super wealthy who use the aggression of the state to maintain and increase their wealth and power. As people who run the government behind the scenes, they are also members of the ruling class who can engage in lawless behavior and lawless violations of the rights of others without repercussions. The final members of the ruling class I'd like to mention are the police. They are not the group of people who have the most individual power, but they are the group who executes the will of the other rulers. They are the ones who do the violent, dirty work of the lawless men. As servants of the modern men and women of lawlessness, they become men and women of lawlessness themselves. Like the other groups mentioned, they are given special privileges and are exempt from being held accountable by the justice system, if not lawfully exempt straight out. They tend to be exempt in practice, especially when compared with the rest of the population. There are at least two ways the police as a whole engage in lawless behavior. The first is that they enforce unjust laws. The job of a law enforcement officer is to enforce laws. This is all well and good with laws like don't murder, don't steal, don't damage other people's stuff, don't threaten or endanger them, and follow through on contracts. But with something like drug laws or laws telling people what they can and can't do with their own body and property, the enforcement of these laws is a human rights violation. The enforcement of the law is an act of violent aggression on another human being, and so is itself an act of lawlessness. They obviously aren't being punished for these lawless acts of law enforcement. The second way the police engage in lawless behavior is through committing crimes like murder and theft. that they frequently get away with. Recently, a study came out which found that 96% of the time when police committed a crime on camera, they weren't even prosecuted. Yes, they were caught on camera committing a crime, but in 24 of every 25 cases, no one took them to court to prosecute them. They weren't even prosecuted. While they don't have legal immunity from the law, as members of the ruling class, they do have functional immunity. This immunity leads to things like the over 1,200 people killed by police in the U.S. last year, and the violent abuses of citizens, numbers which grow rapidly on a daily basis, that the police aren't even required to report because, again, they're a part of the ruling class. The law and the way that the law is enforced and the way that it is judged when it comes to police allows for some of them to be men and women of lawlessness. There is no accountability with the state. Holding coercive monopolies accountable through voting for a tiny percentage of the people in the monopolies every 4 years is impossible. It's like trying to stop the flow of a river with a canoe paddle. You might slow down some of the water around the paddle, but the difference you make will be negligible and barely noticeable, if at all. In all these cases, acting lawlessly without consequence is made possible because of the state, not because of people not having rulers. It's because of the people who are rulers. I'm not meaning to imply that this is all politicians or all big businesses or all police. Of course not. You know better than that. I even know of police officers who only protect others and who claim they do not enforce any laws which are not a violation of the non-aggression principle. That is, they use their position only to prevent and punish aggression and avoid locking people up for victimless crimes. It's neither all the people in these groups, nor is it only these groups. But certainly if we are looking for modern people who fit the archetype of lawlessness, the state is the best place to start. The purposes of authoring this passage we talked about today in their letter to the Thessalonians was multifold. Yes, they wanted the church to know what was coming so they could prepare and be aware and tell others, as well as substantiate their claim that they are the true people of God. But they also wrote it so that these people would have hope. The hope that Jesus gave to the people at the time is that he would see to bringing this man of lawlessness to justice. The hope for them was the promise to set everything right which had been made wrong, and to get rid of those who were acting unjustly toward them, to get rid of those who were destroying the world. God would vindicate his people through his indictment of those who oppose them. There is hope in knowing Jesus will, at least at some point, take care of evil in the world and will solve the problem of the evil deeds enacted on others. The hope is that a just God will act justly by bringing justice to the people who acted unjustly. For the follower of Jesus who rejects the legitimacy of aggressive violence, I think we can and should cling to the same hope. I think that as an anarchist, at least in some ways and in some respects, with one group in particular at least, our eyes are opened a little more, even a little more than we would like them to be, to the evil in the world and to people treating others evilly, and to people acting violently upon others and violently imposing their will on others and making it difficult for others to live and to survive in the world and to function freely as God would have them. We see all these groups of people using violence and its threat, which is a constant subterranean presence when it comes to all government action. So many people don't see it. It's like a It's like a wavelength on the light spectrum that most people can't see until they become aware of how it is that all government functions. And then you just see this violent imposition of one group's will upon another everywhere. And in a world where there's so much evil, and you look at all these people advocating for evil to be done to their fellow human being, and then another group advocating for evil to be done to their fellow human being in a slightly different way, it's just all quite sickening. And then you see all these people being killed all over the world because of governments and because of this belief that violent aggression is not just an inevitability because of the sin in human hearts, but that violent aggression is a good necessity for society to exist. It's also sick and twisted and satanic, and it comes from lies. And when you watch it happening, you just want justice. And you see so little of it sometimes, or it feels like you see so little of it, and even small moments of justice feel like huge victories. Even small moments where people reject this tyrannical way of organizing society feels like a huge victory. Sometimes if you close your eyes and listen with your heart, it feels like you can hear the blood of these victims crying out for justice. This is not right. Things need to change. This should not be happening. Someone needs to stop and remove the people who are doing this to destroy the world. And I think that, like the Thessalonians, where the promise of the letter writers is that out of the breath of Jesus' mouth, this man of lawlessness will be destroyed, I think that we can and should also cling to that hope, where we faithfully see a future and look to the future and seek to bring the future, where Jesus brings them to justice, where the cries of the blood of the victims are heard and answered, and things are set right more and more until they are set right finally and completely, when God comes back to earth, and no man or woman will violently exercise ownership over another person again. That's it for today. If you want to contact me, you can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. You can also visit the website, www.christianarchy.net. There you can do things like enter the number 40 in the search bar, and this episode will come up where you will see a few links to some related topics, either substantiating what I say or expanding on it a little bit. And if you go to the homepage, you can also go to one of the tabs for pages at like the top menu of the screen, I guess is what you call it. I don't really know what you call it. I don't know websites, but I made a fairly new one called But What About? ? And then if you click on that, there are a bunch of different links available to some of the most commonly asked questions when it comes to pragmatic stuff in a free society. Like, what about law and security and dispute resolution and courts and national defense or education? Or what about things like the robber barons or monopolies starting up and then taking advantage of customers and their employees? Information that deals with those questions, mostly by other people, because I don't feel like dealing with them much anymore. Thanks for joining me. Love you guys and gals. Hope life is good, and I hope it's better tomorrow than it was today, and better the next day than it is tomorrow. And then after that, I hope you have a bad day, because if you only have good days where the next day is always better than the previous one, that would feel really unfair to me, and I will engage in envy. So that's that. Okay. Grace and peace.
Another day that carries me. We can make a change.